With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today we're going to look at the immediate aftermath of Pearl Harbor, particularly on Japan's advance through the Pacific, and also on American responses. One of the things that we've looked at in great depth in the past is Japan's motivations for Pearl Harbor, and they are, in brief, basically this. Japan's big strategic goal is the conquest of China. China is where Japan sees itself moving excess surplus Japanese population to, being able to access food and fuel resources, and being able to kind of carve open a kind of a Lebensraum, if you will, in China. China is not easily defeated. The war that the Japanese have hoped they will wage in China has dragged on far longer than anticipated, and the Chinese nationalists have been tacitly helped by Europeans and Americans in Japanese eyes. One of the key reasons for the seizure of Burma from the British was to shut off the Burma Road that ran into southern China, over the Himalayas. So the motivations for the attack on Pearl Harbor come after a season of expansionism during 1940 and 1941, particularly the annexation of French Vietnam by Japan, and this gaining the displeasure of Roosevelt, who looked upon China still as being somewhere where America could have and should have considerable influence, continuing the long-standing ambition by American presidents to operate an open-door policy in China, where China would be a source of a vast marketplace for American goods and a source of cheap raw materials too. So the encroachment of Japanese power in Asia leads to the imposition of sanctions from America, particularly in 1941, particularly oil sanctions and scrap metal sanctions, two things that the Japanese do not have very much of. And Japan, ironically, was reliant on American oil to power its war machine. The next available source of fuel in the Asia-Pacific region are the oil wells of the Dutch East Indies and of Brunei. And so these were to be seized, and the one force that was most likely to prevent this would be the American Pacific Fleet. So it needed to be eliminated before the conquest of the Dutch East Indies could take place. Hence the reason for the attack on Pearl Harbor. Japanese military naval planning had always held that there would have to be, probably against America, some kind of titanic battle in the mid-Pacific, something akin to the battle that actually happens at Midway, where a carrier battle would happen, and then the devastated American fleet would be finished off by Japanese battleships. The British had maintained that a big naval confrontation with Japan should be avoided. Instead, a naval blockade slowly strangling the Japanese home islands into submission would be the way to approach this alarming new power in the East, as far as the British and the Americans saw it. The Japanese were able to firstly deal a devastating blow to the British by the seizure of Malaya, and then in early 1942, the fall of Singapore, thus ending any possible naval strategy in Southeast Asia until the end of the war, and also what they thought was a devastating blow to America by attacking Pearl Harbor. However, all they managed to do was destroy America's warships, not America's carriers. And in the Pacific, in the 1940s, war would be won through aircraft carriers. So today, we're going to read from David Kennedy's Freedom from Fear, and we're going to have a look at his interpretation of the problems that Japan had just created for itself. He writes, "Battleships were the capital weapons of the last war. In the war that was now so bloodily begun, aircraft carriers would be trumps, and no U.S. Pacific Fleet carriers had been at Pearl Harbor on December the 7th. Yorktown had been detached in April for duty in the Atlantic. Saratoga was stateside for repairs. Enterprise and Lexington were at sea near Wake and Midway Islands, respectively. Fuchida's raiders, Fuchida being the commander of the Pearl Harbor raid, had also failed to damage Pearl Harbor's repair shops. More importantly still, they'd left intact the enormous fuel oil tank farm. Loss of that fuel supply, every drop of it laboriously hauled from the American mainland, would have probably forced the US Navy to retreat to its bases on the West Coast, at a stroke sweeping the Western Pacific of American ships more cleanly than any other imaginable action. But Admiral Nagumo rejected suggestions that he undertake a second strike against the repair and fuel facilities or linger in the area to search for the missing carriers. He seemed paralysed by the very ease of his victory. He had lost but 29 aircraft, and his fleet remained unsighted. In Gordon Prang's apt phrase, he must have felt as if he had rushed forward to break down a door just as somebody opened it. For Nagumo, what he had achieved on the morning of December the 7th was victory enough, yet his failure to return for the final definitive kill risked eventual defeat." There were some probably quite naive hopes on the part of Admiral Yamamoto of the task force that a knockout blow against the Americans would force the US to the table, to the negotiating table, with some kind of negotiated settlement about a Japanese sphere of influence in the Pacific would be ironed out and forced, wrung from in a reluctant America. And the fact of the matter was that with four carriers in the Pacific, and the fuel supplies at Pearl Harbor still intact, there was every reason for America to fight on. Also, it seems highly unlikely that an attack so premeditated, so preemptive, but that could ever have resulted in peace negotiations. Perhaps the biggest evidence of a failure at Pearl Harbor is that it did not influence or seem to kind of help the big strategic issue of the war in China one bit. David Kennedy writes, "Even the strategic benefit to Japan of the Pearl Harbor attack was questionable. Yamamoto himself was reported to be deeply depressed in the days after December the 7th. Faced at last with the reality of a war that Japan had such slight prospect of winning. In Chungking, Chiang Kai-shek was so happy he sang an old opera aria and played the Ave Maria all day. Now China's strategic importance would grow even more. American money and equipment would flow in. Winston Churchill remembered thinking, "So we have won after all. Hitler's fate was sealed. Mussolini's fate was sealed. As for the Japanese, they would be ground to powder. There was no more doubt about the end. Being saturated and satiated with emotion and sensation, I went to bed and slept the sleep of the saved and the thankful." There's all sorts of stuff written about, you know, did Churchill know about Pearl Harbor? Did he kind of allow it to happen or fail to warn the Americans? It seems inconceivable that Churchill, despite the kind of the Machiavellian nature of the man, would have acted in such poor faith towards the United States. And it would have been easy enough for Churchill to have shown the Americans plans for Pearl Harbor and for in sort of Zimmerman telegram style, for that to have swayed American public opinion into war anyway. So I treat those kinds of conspiracy theories with caution, mainly because the whole thing about conspiracy theories is they are theorizations that exist where there isn't really evidence to make that case whatsoever. Perhaps in for future decades we will know. The reality, however, of Churchill's response is slightly different. His first reaction on hearing about the attacks was to make an immediate departure for Washington and to make sure that the demand for vengeance against Japan did not start to affect the Lend-Lease Agreement. He did not want to see Japan and Asia become the primary theatre of war against the Axis powers, and he wished for Europe to still be the place where America would focus most of its energies. "Britain must be careful," Churchill advised King George, "that our share of munitions and other aid which we are receiving from the United States does not suffer more than is, I fear, inevitable." In reality, the actual opening up of a front in the Pacific doesn't seem to affect Britain's receipt of war aid whatsoever. Hitler spoke to his generals, saying, "Now it is impossible for us to lose the war. We now have an ally who has never been vanquished in 3,000 years. Taking a kind of a highly romanticised, if not necessarily particularly logical, approach to an alliance with Japan. One of the really interesting things about the Axis is that during the war, there is almost no coordination between Germany and Italy in the West and Japan in the East. There are no conferences where Hitler met the Japanese, no discussion of a kind of an Axis war strategy. Only in the final days of the war are there any sort of remote kind of attempts to perhaps equip one another with things such as nuclear secrets. But even those are kind of patchy and piecemeal and done in the full knowledge that the war was.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Coming to an end. So despite Hitler's kind of rejoicing at Japan's entry into the war, he does not seem to capitalise on this in any meaningful way. The other curious aspect of Hitler's response, and again a missed opportunity, was his decision to declare war on America. David Kennedy writes, though the strict terms of their alliance with Japan did not require it, since Japan had been the attacker, not the attacked, Hitler and Mussolini on December the 11th somewhat impetuously declared war on the United States, which then recognised the state of war with Germany and Italy. Hitler here missed an opportunity to work incalculable mischief with the American commitment to give precedence to the European war. If Hitler had not now obligingly declared war on the United States, Roosevelt, given the apparent willingness of both sides to acquiesce in protracted and undeclared naval warfare in the Atlantic, would have had undoubted difficulty finding a politically usable occasion for declaring war against Germany. In the absence of such a legal declaration, Roosevelt might well have found it impossible to resist demands to place the maximum American effort in the Pacific against a formally recognised Japanese enemy, rather than in the Atlantic in a non-declared war against the Germans. This was precisely Churchill's worry, and it was not easily laid to rest. Well after the German declaration of war, Roosevelt came under stubborn pressure to give priority to the fight against Japan. Pressure came from the Navy, which always took the Pacific War to be its special province, and from public opinion, infected by a legacy of racial animosity towards the Japanese and inflamed by the humiliation of the Pearl Harbor attack. There were those members of Roosevelt's chiefs of staff, particularly Admiral King, who disliked the British and distrusted Churchill and thought, with some degree of justification, that American lives would be sacrificed in order to further British imperial goals. And so there was some insistence on there being a Japan first strategy, though mercifully for the British, this does not prevail. And the question is why Hitler chose to declare war on America when he did. And in order to do this, you have to really go into Hitler's anti-Semitic conspiracy thinking. And it goes something like this. So by late 1941, the German war effort is facing serious reversals in Russia. The Red Army has finally forced the Germans back from the gates of Moscow, and the Russian winter is devastating the German war effort. In addition to this, throughout 1941, Hitler has believed that a war exists between America and Germany anyway. A shooting war at sea has emerged as Lend-Lease and the convoy system has brought America de facto into the war against Great Britain. Who is responsible for all of this? Hitler thinks it's the Jews. There are villainous Jews on Wall Street advising the president to plot against Germany, and there are Bolshevik Jews in Russia who are now planning the downfall of Germany's conquest of Russia. And If they want a war of annihilation, thinks Hitler, then we will give it to them. It's now now in his eyes, the Jewish worldwide conspiracy, as he sees it, has unmasked itself, and Germany will have a fight to the end against them. It's from the summer of 1941 onwards. The final solution is authorised in various kinds of phases, and it is the Wannsee Conference would have happened far closer to the Pearl Harbor attack had it not been for the retreats and the defeats in Russia, the reversals in Russia, and the Wannsee Conference is then scheduled for the early months of 1942, and finally happens on the 20th of January that year. And the significance of all of this is that Hitler had reached a kind of a turning point. If you look at his foreign policy career from 1933 onwards, you have a largely cautious dictator until about 1936, and his remilitarization of the Rhineland, where he calculates that the British and the French are too weak to do anything about, his bluffs, his gambles, and then he becomes ever more a risk taker. Each gamble that pays off convinces Hitler that he can't lose, and Hitler believes that America, whilst having the kind of resources that they have, ultimately haven't quite got the fight in them that the Germans do. And once eventually the eastern territories are conquered all the way up to the River Volga, Germany will have the resources to really bring the fight to the USA. Naive thinking, fantasy thinking, but Hitler had also, at this point, managed to completely and utterly marginalise other voices in decision-making, other people who were able to advise and suggest that this was a strategic gamble of epic proportions. There were a significant number of commentators and politicians in America at the time who were unwilling to accept that the Japanese had pulled off an audacious military attack that the Americans had been unprepared for. There were conspiracy theorists who argued that it had been Roosevelt who had used the American Pacific Fleet as bait in order to draw Japan into an attack and bring America into a war that many Americans were reluctant to join. Whilst this all sounds very attractive as a conspiracy theory, much like the Churchill one, there doesn't seem to be anything in it particularly. And the reality is that Japan had pulled off an audacious military coup and had managed to sail its fleet a considerable distance under radio silence and without alerting American intelligence. Though, of course, the Soviets knew it was going to happen because of their spy in Tokyo, Richard Sorge. The problem here is that wounded national pride will very often look for any other explanation other than the fact that it was a failing on the home team's part. And these things, unfortunately happen. In spite of intelligence, in spite of reconnaissance, in spite of defences. Despite this, and despite the attack on Pearl Harbor, despite the protestations of people like King, Marshall and other members of the chiefs of general staff around that surrounded Roosevelt, all agreed on a Germany first policy, that Germany was the most dangerous adversary and that the conflict with Japan had opened up opened up the possibilities of war. But Japan itself was perhaps the afterthought. The likes of MacArthur, who we'll kind of turn to in the next podcast on this topic, didn't see it that way. MacArthur, kind of rather Napoleonic figure, and his humiliation in his exit from the Philippines after the Philippines fell, which we will look at soon, led him to put immense pressure on Roosevelt to supply him to wage his own personal war in the Pacific. But even so, the War Department still saw Europe as being the primary theatre of conflict. Blame has also fallen on American intelligence and signals across the Pacific, but you have to remember, of course, that the American intelligence in the Pacific was spread very far and very thinly, and the Japanese sphere of influence and the points of attack for the potential Pearl Harbor were immense. Kennedy writes, months, even years of speculation about Japan's military intentions have focused on China, Soviet Siberia, Malaya, Singapore, Hong Kong, the Dutch East Indies, Thailand, Indochina, and the Philippines as possible Japanese targets, but rarely, if ever, Hawaii. The Navy's warning on November the 27th, for example, plausibly named the Philippines, Thai, or the Malay Peninsula, or possibly Borneo, as sites of impending hostilities. Of course, a majority of these places were eventually attacked and conquered by Japan. So the idea that deep in the heart of the Pacific, that the first point of attack, as far as America was concerned, would be Hawaii, was considered, but it was considered also to be too far from the Japanese home islands and to be too well defended. But Japan managed to counter these defences and sail its task force for over 1,000 miles without the use of radio, maintaining non-radio signals. Okay, so we're going to continue from here and to look at the rest of the war in the Pacific bit by bit. And I hope you found this useful and interesting, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. Do remember that if you can fund us on Patreon, that's very, very gratefully received as we survive on a little trickle of ad revenue and the kindness of our patrons. Thank you very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.